Okay, I think we'll make a start. I'm James Kutzel. I'm a professor of development studies in the International Development Department. And I'm actually really happy to introduce Dr. Stephanie Levy, who has been a member of our department for the last few years. Yeah. We have to come over here to the Southeast Asia Center to spend time together. Stephanie is really somebody quite special in our department. She has been teaching. Is it over the last 2 years that you've been teaching? Yeah. And she's a person, a scholar after my own heart, because she has worked extensively for over 15 years of experience in rural development and crossing the boundaries between Southeast Asia and Africa, something that I have encouraged a lot. I mean, I think informing a conversation about and an exchange of knowledge between these two regions is really important. She's worked, she's going to be talking to us tonight about some very innovative programs in social protection in Cambodia and Vietnam. But she's somebody unusual, like I said, who's worked as well in Chad and even on land reform issues in Zimbabwe. And I think some of us would love to have a discussion about that as well. But without further ado, I welcome Stephanie.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm really thrilled to be presenting you the results, the initial results of a study I'm doing on Cambodia and Vietnam. The countries, as you're going to see, are rather different, but they have a lot of similarities in the challenges that they are facing to reduce poverty. So they both are at very different stages of development of their social protection systems. One that is quite well advanced, Vietnam, and one that hasn't even started, Cambodia. And yet, in their poverty profile, they have a common feature, which is that they have stubborn pocket of chronic poverty that the current social protection policies doesn't address properly. They have segment of the rural population that did not benefit from the rapid economic growth that they've experienced, that remain excluded from economic processes and social progress, and they suffer from a number of structural disadvantages. For those populations specifically, the conventional cash transfers that you find in many countries as part of their social protection programs are unlikely to address this multiple disadvantages. They are unlikely to promote the livelihood of this specific population. And for this reason, I've looked at another type of intervention called graduation packages, or the graduation approach, that has been attracting a lot of attention lately because of the innovative way that it tackles, that it aim at unlocking poverty traps. So this is what I'm going to talk about today, how graduation packages has the potential in both countries to promote livelihood of the most extreme poor. One of the questions that is emerging in this debate is whether graduation packages could actually be integrated into the social protection policy of the countries. So as opposed to being projects and experiments and pilots, as you probably have read about, coming from new research, the idea is to integrate this kind of intervention into the social protection system of a country. But to do so, you need to look not just at the microeconomic impact on households, but also at larger, wider economic impact. Looking at markets, looking at trade, and ultimately even looking at growth, because growth is an issue that governments are extremely, especially in Vietnam and in Cambodia, especially interested in. So in order to promote such an intervention, it's important to know what kind of impact could be expected at the macroeconomic level. The initial results of this study are very encouraging, and they show substantial and sustained impact at the household level. But they also show that there are a range of economic benefit that could be identified, not just for the beneficiaries, but for the communities around them, and even at the macroeconomic level in terms of economic growth. And I think this is a specificity that you don't find with cash transfer that easily, but that we have managed to identify in the case with this study. So in this presentation, I'm going to present you the graduation approach. I'm then going to discuss the relevance of the graduation approach for Cambodia and for Vietnam, given their poverty profiles. And then I will show you the analytical framework that I've developed to answer these questions. So I will show you the model that I designed, and I will show you the number of simulation scenarios that I looked at to answer those questions. We're going to then discuss what the policy implication could be, but also we're going to look at how they relate to other studies that have been conducted, especially for Vietnam. So, the graduation approach. So, you might have heard about graduation models, so graduation packages, and they typically refer to multifaceted programs that aim at enabling the extreme poor to graduate out of poverty. They are inspired by programs that were originally designed by BRAC in Bangladesh, and they consist in a combination of complementary measures that each addresses one specific dimension or cause of poverty at the household level. So the BRAC approach to graduation is based on five pillars, or five building blocks. The first one is that they need to target extremely poor household, or they also call ultra poor household in the BRAC terminology. They need to support consumption of the participants regularly throughout the program so that they will protect them from potential financial shocks and stresses. They consist in a transfer of a productive asset or productive assets that the household are usually able to choose. They involve the provision of skills and vocational training throughout the length of the program, regularly, sometimes at a weekly pace or monthly, on a monthly basis. And lastly, they also offer a number of financial facilities, such as saving facilities, for example, which matter a lot for how the household manages their new streams of income. The objective of this holistic approach is to enable participants to unlock the poverty trap and secure durably their livelihood by providing with a big push. They aim at generating streams of income through self-employment, aiming for self-sufficiency. So currently there has been a development in many countries around the world adopting this approach, either on the initiative of NGOs or UN organization, but also as a choice from several governments around the world who see this kind of measure as a way of reducing the population that depends on the social protection system. So last week, the World Bank produced this slide, which is not mine, and it counted 99 initiatives around the world. Can you see the map really well? I don't know. It's Athena. Okay, on my screen it comes really nicely. But as you can see, there are programs in Latin America, Africa, Asia, and the majority of projects is currently in sub-Saharan Africa, which is very good news, I think. So I'm sorry if you can't see this, but while it's initially started in Bangladesh, an initiative by BRAC, it is now expanding very rapidly. So what do we know about their efficiency? What do we know about the kind of whether they manage or not to achieve their aim? Well, we have a body of literature that is now emerging, and more particularly, we have two papers, one by Duflo and her team, and another one here at LSE by Oriana Bandera and her colleagues as well, that has identified a set, a broad set of long-lasting effects. So on income, on accumulation of productive assets, accumulation of skills, they've identified that this kind of packages manage to achieve the aim of unlocking poverty trap over sometimes more than 7 years, over a period of time that can go up to 7 years, which is what the RCT had taken as a period for evaluation. So even 7 years after the program had started, you can still find impact on household income. This research has also concluded that while we can observe the outcome of the intervention afterwards, it's still hard to identify what is driving the results. It's also difficult to identify what the impact is on the non-beneficiaries. And if those measures have to be scaled up, then it's important to understand not just the impact on the local community, but also possibly on their local market, which is something that this kind of study doesn't look at. Those packages are typically more expensive, as you can imagine, than conventional cash transfers. Nonetheless, from the results that we can see already, and BRAC has published a number of studies showing that the programs are likely to pay for themselves if you adopt a long-term perspective to evaluate the impact. What we're going to see today with the results that I've managed to produce just on time for this seminar, you will see that the participants of the program are not the only one to benefit from it. So even when the fiscal space is constrained, and even when the poverty incidence isn't small, there is a consensus nowadays around the fact that the program might pay for itself, so that the return on the investment might actually be quite substantial. Now, because governments are now talking about including this kind of intervention into their social protection program, it is important to look at the macroeconomic impact. So the RCTs, while RCTs can be extremely productive in evaluating the efficiency at the household level, if the aim is for those projects to become a policy, it's really important to adopt a macroeconomic perspective as well, complement the microeconomic studies with a macroeconomic perspective, which is what we're going to do today. So Vietnam and Cambodia. The social protection system in Vietnam is quite patchy. It is based on a life cycle categorical transfers that predominantly aim childhood, working age, and elderly population. The coverage that they offer to the poor is quite minimal, in a sense that the transfer that they provide those potential beneficiaries are very low. So while Vietnam has been really good at identifying the poor, the social protection system, more precisely the social protection, the social assistance that has been put in place, remain insufficient to provide safety net to quite a significant part of the population. So the government there is well aware of the fact that for a middle-income country, what is currently offered is insufficient to address the poverty at its roots. There is a quote that I find, which was I find quite striking, by Kid et al. In a paper that reviewed the social protection system in Vietnam, that says that the current social assistance transfer system is not fit for purpose for a middle-income country, which is, I think, quite a strong, maybe a bit too strong to my view, statement. But it reveals the fact that the transfers that are offered are very low, and they do not allow to provide a safety net, a proper safety net, to the household that needed the most. Now, if we look at the poverty profile of the country in more details, and we try and understand what is not working, there is, of course, a very striking fact, which is that poverty is concentrated among the ethnic minority groups, predominantly. So while the poverty rate of these minority groups is estimated around 60%, it is only around 10% for the majority Kin and Oa population. The 53 ethnic minority group constitute less than 15% of the population, and yet they represent 2/3 of the extreme poor. For the past 2 decades, since poverty has been started to be measured, the concentration of minorities among the poor has continued to rise. Also, the depth and the severity of the poverty is stronger among these minority groups. If you look at this map here, that shows you the distribution of the poor in Vietnam, it is really striking that it is strongly correlated with the ethnicity of the population. So if you look at this map here that reflects the poverty rate in 99, and you compare it to the one for 10 years later, what you can see, although it's not very clear on the map, is that the area where the minority, ethnic minority live hasn't become clearer. If you look at the maps, you can see that the poverty rate by ethnicity shows a striking feature. Look, even the Kin population living in the poorest area shows a low poverty rate, around 10% on average, whereas the red part of the map, which corresponds to the northern mountains and the central island, have remained red. Right, so that gives you a first indication of the fact that the pattern, that the growth process, while they have benefited the majority, did not benefit in the same way the ethnic minority groups in this specific area. If we try and look closer at the characteristics of the livelihood of this population, it is striking that the livelihood hasn't changed that much since the early 90s. There is less infrastructure and much poorer connectivity to the rest of the economy. There is low educational achievement, limited job skills and employment opportunities. This population is heavily dependent, the ethnic minorities are heavily dependent on subsistence agriculture, which is a predominant source of income. They have more difficult access to social services, and they live in geographical insulation. So their integration onto the larger local economy is weak. They're also exposed to natural disasters and risks because of where they live, typically in the island. The fact that the living standard between these groups and the majority and the Kin majority has continued to rise raise the issue of what has the policy system done, what has the social protection system done about it, and what can be done about it. It seems clear when you look at the graphs that I'm going to show that there is a that there are stubborn pockets of poverty that needs to be differently targeted. So if you look at the first graph, for example, and you look at how the poverty rate has evolved over time, you can see that the red bars that correspond to the poverty rate for ethnic minorities have declined. As you can see, the poverty rates has declined. Nonetheless, look at the gap between the blue bars and the green bars. You can see that the gap is increasing. And if you look more closely at the district level, you can see a very strong correlation between the percentage of the ethnic minority population in a given place and their poverty rate. So one last graph just to show you this even more simply. If you look at the density for the distribution of welfare, so if you look at how, if you plot how the welfare is distributed among the different population within Vietnam, you can see the dots, the line, the vertical line in dots here correspond to the poverty line. Now, as you can see, for the ethnic minority welfare density function, the majority of the curve is before the line, whereas for the blue one, the large part of the density is after the line, right? So I think that gives us some evidence about the fact that ethnic minority do require more than what is currently offered to them with the social protection system in Vietnam. If we now look at the case of Cambodia, we can find some similarities, but not geographically. So what Cambodia has managed to achieve over the past 20 years is a very rapid decline in its poverty rate. So like Vietnam did, Cambodia also managed to reduce quite drastically the poverty incidence within its population. From an estimated 53% in 2004, the poverty rate is now estimated to be around 18% in 2014, and the current estimate that I did for this study using the most recent data shows that it can even be now considered to be around 12% for the past using the last household survey. So the decline has been sharp, it's been quite impressive, and it's been mainly driven by the growth of the agricultural sector. The agricultural sector has experienced a major structural transformation in Cambodia. From subsistence, it became a commercial, the sector changed into a more commercial agricultural sector, which is more modern as well. And to give you an idea of how fast it grew, it had been the fastest achieving agricultural sector in terms of its growth for the period 2002-2012 among all Asian countries. So according to the World Bank, this is the highest annual poverty rate in the region, around 10% a year, at around 10% a year. Now you can see that for all the rural population that depends on agriculture to survive, this has been a tremendous opportunity for them to generate new income and to trade their goods. So the ADB also reported that there has been an increase in productivity by Cambodian farmers and that yields have now joined the regional average. And for some crops, it has even exceeded the regional average. What is really striking is that this structural transformation was done with very little support from the government. So it is the farmers, it is Cambodian farmers that have managed to make the most of the opportunities they had due to changes in the price of rice and in, you know, finding new exporting opportunities, accumulating capital, and becoming more productive. Nonetheless, there are major challenges that Cambodia will now be facing. First of all, the agricultural sector production is slowing down. And this is a potential threat for millions of households who depend on this, on the agricultural sector to survive. So a further slowdown could actually compromise the livelihood of millions who are very vulnerable to minor changes in their income. So to give you an idea, the World Bank estimated that a change in those households, for those households specifically, for those rural farmers who live just above the poverty line, if their income was to change by the equivalent of two bottles of water, so the price of two bottles of water sold in the street by vendors, and the poverty incidence will double in Cambodia. So that gives you a clear, I think, indication of how vulnerable those households actually are. So if you think about the density function we had just before, we saw for Vietnam, you have something similar in Cambodia where you have a high concentration of population just above the poverty line. There are also striking regional differences in Cambodia, and there is a really weak market integration in many parts of the country. This means that there are, like they are in Vietnam, there are stubborn pockets of poverty where some population remain isolated from markets, they remain isolated from the economic processes around them, and not only are they very vulnerable, but they also do not have the means to change their livelihood. The new Cambodia National Social Protection Framework plans to implement policies that will transfer monthly stipend to extremely poor household on the basis of how many children they have attending schools. It also involves a pension for the elderly part of the population, but that's all. So it means that even the new National Social Protection Framework will not offer a social protection floor for those households, right? The transfers are going to be low, and only a part of the population will be eligible to those transfers. As you can see, with the case of Vietnam, it's also the case for Cambodia, a cash transfer, and we're going to discuss this further in the presentation, is unlikely to address this issue of stubborn chronic poverty. But graduation packages, as we just discussed just before, might do, because they do involve the provision of the transfer of a productive asset, and because they do allow participants to have access to additional training and to vocational professional skills and vocational training, it could possibly do so. So if we try and look at what are the common challenges for both Vietnam and Cambodia in terms of their poverty reduction strategies, it is clear that they are managed, that while those two countries have managed to decrease their poverty incidence, and they have managed to, because of the growth, they've managed the economic growth, while they have managed to sharply decline their poverty incidence, they still both have stubborn pockets of poverty that are not currently targeted by the social protection systems. What is common in both countries, for both ethnic minorities and for Cambodia ultra poor, is that they suffer from similar forms of economic exclusion and binding constraint to their livelihood improvement. So they have low access and also low education record, low access to professional skills and vocational training, very few productive assets, poor access to markets, and also there are credit constraints. So you can, one of the images that I think is quite useful in a case like that is you can picture like high-hanging fruit. So when the growth happened in those countries, the low-hanging fruit, so the one that were more easily included, that participate more easily, that could be included in the economic processes, were the first one to benefit from new income, right? But the one who were more isolated and who were not participating to market activities were the one that actually are still the one that are not included into those processes. So they are the high-hanging fruits, more difficult to target, more difficult to help. And if they haven't benefited from the growth so far, we can ask ourselves, are they likely to benefit from growth in the future, especially if this growth starts declining? So both countries need a social protection floor to provide safety nets to those living in extreme poverty. But both countries also need effective programs for poverty reduction that will target specific factors of marginalities. So supporting their access to productive resources, strengthening their skills development, also shifting out for subsistence activities into more commercial agriculture. The diversification of the productive from the agricultural production has been proven to be really effective at improving income. For all this, in all these respects, while the cash transfer, conventional cash transfer, might not be able to facilitate and to target specifically those factors of marginalization, we believe that graduation package would. So there is evidence in the literature that cash transfers have facilitated savings and they have promoted investment. However, the size of the saving and the size of the potential investment remains small. So think about an ultra-poor household living in Cambodia. When they receive a cash transfer, the likelihood that they will manage to save part of it if they are far from the poverty line is low. So even if they do manage to save part of it, they're still exposed to a number of financial shocks and stresses that will potentially take these savings to, that will require these savings in order to respond to those shocks and stresses. So the idea that combining safety net with productive assets transfer and the development of skills could be a really good one to address the constraints or the market failure and target those left behind by rapid economic growth. The results I'm going to show you now are going to be I'm going to show you now results from a study that I did for Cambodia that was commissioned by UNDP. And I'm going to show you how this can be applied to Vietnam. I would like to thank the SEAC, by the way, for helping me gathering the data that I need to replicate the study that I'm going to show you now that I did for Cambodia and to do it for Vietnam as well. So the results for Cambodia are quite well advanced, and the one for Vietnam, this is just starting to come up now. So about the methodology, what methodology did I use to answer those questions? So I wanted to look at the trade-offs between different types of social protection intervention. I wanted to look not just at the household, but also at their dependence on local market for work, but also for consumption. So I wanted to build a model that will represent the economy in which they are part. I wanted to not just look at whether they were extreme poor or not, but also look at the distance to the poverty line, because as you can see, this is a very important aspect of the efficiency of a policy. For this reason, I developed what is called a general equilibrium model. And those models, for those of you who are familiar with them, they take a snapshot of the economy at a given point of time. They are used it's a very current, very common tool that developing countries use to try and estimate the impact that policy choice will have on the economy. So the way it works is that all the agents are included in the model, they're all integrated, but what we look at is at a given point of time, so for a given year, what were the financial flows that happened in the economy? So if you look at households here, they depend on the commodity market to consume, but they also sell their productive factors, so the labor, onto the factor market, which are then used by economic activities, productive activities, to produce goods that are put on the market. So those are loops, if you want, that reflect the relationship between the different economic agents. Those tools are very efficient, very useful to look at industrial policies, trade policies, all sorts of macroeconomic policies that are likely to influence the private sector and trade. But they're not so good to analyze issues related to household and to poverty. So what I did is I developed a household model within the general equilibrium model. So if you want, I developed for Vietnam and for Cambodia, I designed a household model specifically for the potential participants of a graduation program. And what I tried to look at was what would be the impact of the transfers if those households were provided with all the typical elements of the graduation package. Yeah? So I also did a range of micro simulation in order to look, as we explained before, not just at whether household is poor or not, but at the distance between the poverty threshold and their income. So I wanted to look at the poverty gap, not just the poverty incidence. So I developed this model, used the data for Vietnam and for Cambodia to build the data set that I needed to estimate the impact of the measures. And then I looked at a number of possible interventions. The first one was a conventional cash transfer scenario, where the household will receive monthly every month the household, the beneficiaries, will receive this exact same amount of money throughout the year. Because I wanted to look at the impact of a scaling up of graduation packages, I decided to target 1 million extreme poor in the case of Cambodia. It's a lot. It represents about 200,000 households. But I assume that they will get a small amount of money. So a lot of people are getting a little bit of money in those scenarios. They are always the same household in every one of the scenarios that I look at. And it's always the exact same amount of total funding that is used. So you have an envelope that you want to use for social protection. We're going to look at what happens if you use it to just transfer cash, like many countries in the world do, on the basis of the poverty criteria. Then I'm going to compare what happens if instead of giving cash, you give, for example, half of it in the form of a productive asset and half of it in the form of cash. Or if you do a combination of training, productive assets, and cash. And I'm going to compare the outcome of those different scenarios. The total amount required for these measures is equivalent to 0.6% of the GDP. So it's a very small envelope at the scale of the country. And yet, you can manage to target 1 million people with a lump sum amount of money in a substantial way. So when I compare the impact of the graduation package in Cambodia to what would have happened if they would have just received cash, I find something really interesting. The household who receive the productive asset, because they start producing food, also I should have mentioned that, I've left the choice open of what productive asset they would need. So in the model, the way it's modeled is that they can choose what productive asset they need. Once they get this combination of cash and asset, they can then use this asset to produce agricultural products mainly, right? And what was really striking in this scenario is that the number of households, of individuals who graduated, so who are not poor anymore after 1 year of the intervention, was about 40% of all the participants. So 400,000 individuals graduated out of poverty with just 1 year of transfer in the first year, if you compare the first year. If I had just been given cash, to give you a comparison point, it would have been 443. So you see the difference is really small if you compare what happened if you just give cash to what happened if you give a combination of cash and productive asset. But what's really interesting, there are two really interesting results. The first one is that half of this effect comes from productive activities that the household have managed to create themselves. So the new consumption, if you want, the additional consumption that is allowed by the intervention allows half of this effect. Half of the effect that you find comes from their own productive activities, as opposed to the effect you have when all you do is giving cash, right? So if you give cash, obviously they will consume more. But if you give the productive asset, they will generate income that will give them half of the effect that you find on their consumption. So they still get a bit of money, but they get that. Also, very interestingly, the agricultural production at the level of Cambodia increases by 1.25%, which is a result that I've never managed to achieve with any kind of cash transfer policy in the simulations. So you have an impact on the local market, but you also have an impact on growth, on economic growth, at a level which is estimated around 0.23%. So this is something quite unique with graduation packages and quite valuable, as you can see. So that reveals the enabling impact of the graduation packages compared to conventional cash transfers. There is a significant improvement in the targeted household income, and 4 out of 10 actually move out of poverty after one period. The other scenario that I looked at was one that combines skills and productive asset plus cash. So this is much closer to what the actual graduation package includes, and the results were very similar. Again, there is an increase in the agricultural production at the level of the country, and there is a growth impact, and yet the number of poor who graduate is very comparable to what you get if all you do is giving cash. But there is one element that you do not have with cash that you do have with graduation, which is a longer term impact. So if they do accumulate asset, they will be able to produce the year after they receive the intervention, right? So instead of looking at just 1 year, I looked at two. And then I found that the impact of the graduation package continue to operate after the program has stopped. So, and the impact continues to be found both at the household level and at the macroeconomic level. So if you look at this graph here, what I did on this graph is I compared the pure cash transfer intervention with one that is similar to a graduation package. And what I found is that, yes, in the first year, the cash transfer do achieve a bit more poverty reduction, right? But if you look at what happened after 2 years, you exceed the impact, whatever kind of graduation package you look at, right? So that implies that in order to estimate fully the impact, the return on the investment, you need to adopt a long-term strategy. The last graph I want to show you is a bit more difficult to explain, but let's see if I can do this. There are trade-offs, obviously, between different interventions, right? We saw that some of them do promote growth, but others don't. So if you are the prime minister in Cambodia, you want to decide what kind of budget you're going to allocate to your social protection policies, you will not just look at poverty incidence. You will also consider the growth impact, right? And so what I did is I tried and put, one by one, for each intervention, what the impact will be for the targeted households, for the overall poverty level in the country, and for growth. So looking at those three indicators through a range of intervention gives you a good idea of the trade-offs that you have to consider when you decide on what to include in your social protection intervention. While the cash transfers did allow a higher return on the poverty incidence, it didn't have an impact on growth. But when you compare that with different graduation intervention, they did, and they did remarkably well. They did stimulate growth. When you look at the longer term, which is those two graphs, you can almost put those one on top of them if you want to have a look at the total economy, total impact, then it starts to be quite clear what the graduation package does. And you then can see that for a government that has a limited budget to allocate to social protection every year, the fact that you allow 40% of the participants to graduate out of poverty is a very important element, because it means that those households will not be dependent on your social protection system anymore in 2 years, maybe three, right? So yes, I did. So those were the results for Cambodia. The ones for Vietnam I'm working on now, so I haven't been able to come today with a similar set of graphs for Vietnam, but I'm hoping it will be soon. Nonetheless, the results for Cambodia show that there is a catalyst effect of productive asset and professional training that persists when the programs stop. And at an equal level of funding, the cumulative effect of poverty reduction over 2 years exceeds those of conventional cash transfers. The graduation approach also fosters inclusion into the local social economic fabric. And very importantly, about half of the new consumption that is generated is financed by the household's own productive activities in the case of a graduation package. I did find a number of multipliers and synergies as well. And if you look at the publication on the UNDP website that shows those results, you will find a lot more results on multipliers at the local economic level. In the case of Vietnam, although I didn't do, I haven't managed to finish on time for today, the simulation results, I just want to tell you two small things. There has been a study that looked at what did the ethnic minority communities do to graduate out of poverty. So they did the World Bank conducted a number of surveys, qualitative surveys, to try and understand what had worked, what did work for the ones that are not poor anymore. And they found that the strategy that has been adopted is the following one. First of all, the household, the ethnic minority household who are not poor anymore, were not poor at the time of the survey, were the ones that started by diversifying their agricultural activities. The diversification into cash crops allowed them to accumulate productive assets and savings sufficiently to then move on to more intensive agriculture. The process, on average, took about 5 years. It was a very risky process, and many of them did not succeed to reach this stage of not being poor anymore. So it's a long process, it's a risky process. The graduation packet, and you're welcome to look at the whole study if you want to understand exactly what they found. But what I thought was really interesting is that all the elements that were identified in this success story were the one that the graduation packages target specifically. Accumulation of productive assets, accumulation of skills and training, access to the capital that is needed to start this more intensive agriculture, linkages to markets. On all these specific steps and stepstone towards graduating out of poverty, the graduation package operates at once earlier on in the process. So it's less risky for households to engage in those activities. And to finish the presentation, I would like to read one quote that I think is really informative here. And it's a quote by Wells Dong, who did the study on the successful stories in Vietnam. And he said that cohesive communities of people who are not poor have better chances of maintaining their language, religions, and other cultural traditions than those who are struggling to make a living, and that communities who are struggling better than communities who are struggling at the edge of subsistence. So hopefully graduation packages could similarly allow preserving culture, identities, and tradition as opposed to migration that obviously would compromise that. Thank you very much.
So just as we gather our thoughts in terms of questions for Stephanie, I wanted to wait to hear your presentation to make grand claims. And so this is a presentation of research in progress, just the kind of research that the Southeast Asia Center is very enthusiastic about funding. And so we're a center that's bringing together faculty members from across the school who are interested in Southeast Asia. And if you found this interesting, we have a Southeast Asia forum in May, which is May 21, where researchers from within and outside the school come together to talk about pressing policy issues. So it's kind of a flagship activity of the Southeast Asia Center here. So this example of Stephanie's work, this is a product of research funding. And we hope to bring you part two in the future. But it does convince me that the kind of thing that we're doing here out of the center is really important. And the complementarities of this research work between what it contributes to academic knowledge with what it, we can see very clearly here, and we'll start to debate it now, I think the policy implications of this are really, really important. So, on that note, I would like, I have a whole bunch of questions, but I get to talk to you afterwards as well, so I'll wait and see, and first open the questions to the floor. Yes? And could you please wait for the microphone because we're recording.
Thanks. Thanks very much. That's a fascinating talk. I also have a bunch of questions, so I'll try and limit it to one or two. Can I first ask, what poverty line are you using? And what are these productive assets that you talk about in practice? Is it like livestock or what are we talking about? And then the kind of comment that I have, which is like I really think this simulation is got a lot of potential, but you know, the difference between simulations and what actually happens in practice can be quite massive, and it seems, for what I know about the struggles with the stubborn poverty of Vietnam's ethnic minorities, is that ethnic discrimination is a huge factor in limiting opportunities for minorities. So say you give them these training and opportunities and stuff, but they go to the job market and they consistently get half the wage of the ethnic Vietnamese labourer. You know, how are these factored into your simulation?
Yeah.
That's very good. Do you want to collect a few questions or answer them one by one?
I'm happy to do them one by one so I don't forget things. Thank you. So the poverty line for Vietnam, they started adopting a multi-dimension estimate of poverty, but nonetheless, all the figures that you saw now have been using the food poverty line. In Cambodia, it has always been the food poverty line, and it is still the food poverty line. So I use both the rural and urban food poverty line, which I consider being really useful for estimating extreme poverty. Obviously, if you can't eat what you need to survive, you are extremely poor. In terms of the choice of assets, that's a very good question. So in the model that you just saw now, they have the choice between livestock and tools. So One of the favorite Cambodian livestock choice of livestock is goats, because you don't need to have a lot of land to keep a goat at home with you. You don't need to have like you would have with a cow. Mm. So you know I know the results from the Bandeja and Etal results are with cows, but Cambodian rural households are sometimes they are landless for the most part.
Yeah.
And so we've looked at goats, chickens, but also tools, and tools especially for irrigation purposes, which there is a big demand for. Irrigation in Cambodia currently, the level of irrigation at the country level is around 8%, which is 10 times smaller than this of Vietnam. So Vietnam has something around the 75%. Cambodia is, I think, if I remember well, 7.9. So there is a really large range for, you know, improving how the water is used. So those were the different options that were included in the modeling. In terms of ethnic discrimination, that's a very, very important question. The whole objective of doing something like this is for them to create their own stream of income. So while there is discrimination for when you apply for a job, so you know on the labor market, you can imagine that you will address those constraints if they start generating their own productive activities. So the whole objective is for them to choose what they would like, how they want to diversify, and from then on to create their own productive activities. So that will obviously address this issue.
Yes? Other questions? Okay. You have to raise your hand higher because my chair is low.
Thanks for the presentation. I really liked it. But I had a few questions about how the graduation. In all of the graduation packages, there's about 50% that's cash. So when the graduation program kind of stops, it's kind of an abrupt transition into being a loan, although they become self-sufficient with the lifestyle. But how can you tackle the issue of dependence on the protection system when the cash stops so abruptly, since you were saying that for every month they would receive the same amount of money and then it suddenly stops? And also, if people graduate out of poverty, they're still really close to the poverty line, so they're at risk, they're really vulnerable and at risk of falling back down, back into poverty. So would you aim to tackle that, kind of prevent kind of receding and people falling back down into the poverty line?
Yes, so they're actually related, your questions about dependency and vulnerability. The Duflo papers, which looked at what happened 7 years after, found that really looked at this specifically, this issue of vulnerability, whether they were going to fall back, and found that many of them didn't. So, we're not saying that once you provide a graduation package, it's a magic bullet and you will solve the issue of poverty and vulnerability in the country. And in fact, there will always be a need for a social protection floor for all the ones who cannot participate to those productive activities. There will always be a need for regular social safety nets for the disabled population, This is not questions at all. There will always be a need for that. But the idea is that once the stream of productive activities start, the dependency on the cash disappears, right? Progressively, with time. So the process is likely to be long. And I was at a conference last week just on graduation where I heard a lot of results on RCTs, you know, many different countries around the world. And they were saying that for the majority of the participants, it did work and allowed them not to become dependent on the system anymore. But there is always a proportion of the participants that will fall back. Why? Because they are vulnerable to shocks and stresses, financial shocks and financial stresses. And, you know, you might sell your assets when you have a shock like that, right? So the skills will remain. The asset will be gone. And there are actually even papers in the literature, for example, Blattmann et al., who actually found that, yes, they did invest, and when they were offered the, in their case it was a grant, they did accumulate productive assets. But after 3-4 years, he looked at, 4 years, some of them have resold their assets. And that's, you know, something that obviously the graduation package, there's only so much you can do. So it's not going to solve the poverty at all, or the vulnerability, but it can offer ways to address the issue of marginalization and exclusion. We need to remain modest, I think.
RCTs, by the way, are randomized control trials.
Yeah, randomized control
trials. Just for those who are not into the alphabet soup.
Sorry.
Development. Do I see other questions coming here?
Yes.
Did you plan or did you carry out any regression discontinuity analysis of cash transfers? Because I think this would be interesting to look at how the people have used it. Even they receive money, they can use it in different ways, or didn't use it at all. So this makes kind of bias the conclusion. This is my question.
Perhaps you can explain first the terms of the question.
Yes. You asked me whether I had conducted any economic analysis to see what were the determinants of the use of the cash for investment, right? So personally, I haven't conducted an economic study of this kind, but there is a really large body of evidence in the literature currently looking specifically at this. Now, there is a bit of controversy. I mean, this is a difficult issue. This is a difficult issue because there is a school of thought that says, just give the cash, they will invest. And there is other economists, like me, who said, actually, the evidence that they would save is small, and the chances that what they save will be reinvested is even smaller. So I personally believe that there is a lot you can do with cash, but to promote livelihood, they're not enough. They're not sufficient. I believe they're not sufficient. Or they will have to be at a much higher level than what is currently done around the world. And that will be politically very difficult to sell. But no, I haven't done the econometric estimate. But we are now talking about doing a random control trial to test the hypothesis on behavior. So the next stage of this in Cambodia will be to compare what households are likely to do if they're giving one package instead of another, and then look at the investment behavior specifically. This is a very important question. But I don't have an answer to this in Cambodia.
Just while I'm waiting for some... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, thank you for that. I was wondering what are the political incentives for those in power to introduce such graduation packages? Won't simple cash transfers be preferable, given that transfer of, say, skills and education takes a lot of time? It's not really. So what would be the political incentives there?
So the political incentive would be to decrease the population in need of cash transfers, of the safety net, if you want. It would be to reduce. So adopting a longer-term strategy, the idea would be to say, you have here a population among which a lot can work, a lot can actually become self-sufficient. You're not using them. Efficiently, you're not using your funding efficiently to address what they would need to do so. So the idea will be, by graduating, the population that will depend on your social protection system will decline over time. This is an argument that the African governments who are testing this kind of packages are very sensitive, they're very aware of, and they're very, very receptive of. So I found personally, having discussed these issues with a few government members of the government in Africa, like, you know, Ethiopia, for example, Uganda, another example, there is an awareness of the high potential for them to graduate their potential candidates. So they, yes, they do see the benefit of that. In Vietnam and Cambodia, it's far more difficult. So we're working now with the Prime Minister Economic Advisor in Cambodia, and it takes a really long effort, a lot of time. One of them I've known for many years, so I have been discussing those issues with him, not graduation, but social protection, for more than a decade. I think the argument about the investment paying for itself is one that is more easy to sell. But it's far from being done, by all means, but it's considered now. It's considered, not just because of these, there are programs, and, in Vietnam, I found that it's very difficult to discuss those issues because of the political setting around social protection. So they have different ministries who are responsible for implementing different parts of the whole social, you have three components. You have the social, you have three components around labor market measures, elderly pensions, scholarship. They are very possessive. Each ministry is very possessive of their own policies. And ideally, they are aware that it should be harmonized and a unique system should be put in place to make it more efficient. It's very far from being done. But the ethnic minority argument is one that goes around those issues of political resistance, because this is one that almost everyone is aware of. So it's almost a separate issue, if you want, in the eyes, in the way it's done in Vietnam politics. It's almost a separate. So this, I think, could have the potential, could be appealing, but it's not done.
I think that's really interesting, and it kind of gets on to, by asking about the politics and the political incentive. Interestingly, you said that this rather rapid achievement in reduction of poverty in Cambodia from 53% in 2004 to just 12% now, and it was driven by quite impressive growth in agriculture. That was basically opening up or allowing farmers to respond to market incentives.
Yes.
This is what it seems that you were saying. But for a step change in Cambodia, wouldn't one have to think beyond that?
Yeah.
And beyond these kinds of programs you're talking about? So in other words, you talked about the very huge potential for irrigation. This is not going to happen without state programs for irrigation, and so we see accumulation and public investment, right, as a key component of changing prospects in Cambodia. First, and then second, I mean, this is true for both Cambodia and Vietnam. While there still seems to be a great potential to gain returns on investment in agriculture, these populations, there's far too many people dependent on agriculture. So in other words, the diversification first in agricultural production is showing great, results, but there has to be a diversification towards manufacturing, et cetera, if this is going to be a sustainable change. Right? So I'm just wondering how you, these are more reflective questions on the implications of your research.
Yeah, thank you. They're very relevant questions. The complementarity between social protection and rural development, more largely, is a key one. So in the paper, in the Cambodia paper, what I did, you probably saw that there were more bars on the graph, is that I looked at a completely different type of investment, which was public investment in infrastructures. That was the first one. So roads, because it's all a story about isolation in there. And second, on irrigation specifically. So those were two scenarios where I actually found the highest return from anything I tested so far. So I've never had such high returns. So in other terms, this is not this cannot be done at the scale of the household. This is not for the household to actually, you know, electrify part of the community where they are. It's not the household who can develop those big, large irrigation systems. It is the role of the government. So the idea with those additional scenarios was to look at the complementarity in a way. But there is a lot of, I think there are even papers that specifically explain why an efficient social protection policy should be embedded in a larger rural development program. So it's not in isolation, it should be done in combination, if you want, because the synergies are massive. And so I also did a paper just on that for IFPRI,
right.
Where we looked at the complementarity specifically between cash transfers and public investment. And we found that depending on what kind of indicator you choose, there are different combinations that work best, but if all, whatever indicator you choose, even if your indicator is poverty and only poverty, it always works better to always allocate a part of your budget to the development of your rural economy. So yes, definitely, that's a very good point. And the diversification toward manufacturing is exactly what the government is expecting, which is why they are currently investing in a number of industrial policies, and you know they are implementing industrial policies, and they have all their efforts are currently put in this diversification strategy, because this is where they also see their comparative advantage in terms of, you know, having exporting sectors. Textile, tourism is a really productive sector in Cambodia, developing fast. And so, but for the households that do remain in those specific villages, either you target them directly or you expect them to migrate. So that's the situation. So this is why, you know, yes, there is a relevance for some. The migration is happening and it will continue to happen. And I think that's what the government is also expecting to happen. So, yeah.
Other questions?
I mean, I'm
really good. Go ahead. You're allowed, since
Sure.
It seems non-competitive at the moment.
Great. So it's interesting how there's this kind of logic of these graduation packages, which are trying a big push towards self-sufficiency,
but
they expect to achieve that by helping or encouraging people out of subsistence, which is maybe a bit, you know, there's a bit of an odd logic there, because you think, okay, well, they're going to stop farming for themselves, but you're expecting them to become self-sufficient through commercial agriculture. And again, I'm just talking about Vietnam, so, but I'm sure it applies otherwise. As Wells Dang's article said, and you said as well, like this commercial agricultural route is much more risky for poor households, because they might invest a lot in some cash crop, and then suddenly the price might drop.
Exactly.
And if you're encouraging everyone to get into these cash crops as well, this happens. If you look at, don't take such a macro level, but you look into a specific example, and everyone starts growing plums in the same village, the price of plums drops, and everyone gets fed up and goes back to farming the rice. And I even wonder if Wells Dang's, interviews on the wealthy, successful ones, there's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, because you didn't ask all the ones who didn't make it. And so again, I wonder how you can fit these into your simulation and how you factored that in.
Thank you. So just to be clear, I don't think the idea is to encourage giving up subsistence farming, and the majority of them don't give up. The idea is to diversify, because the returns for this kind of cash crops, of activity, and marketed products are higher. And so if they remain in their subsistence activity always, this is what they've been doing so far, there is no route out of poverty if all they do is cultivate for themselves, and you know there is a very modest amount of trading within the community. So a way of increasing income is by starting cash crop production in order to market your production. So yes, it's riskier, it has higher return, but the idea is not to exclusively do that. I think the example I took, that you may write to mention this, the example I took was quite striking. I had to read it probably three times because I found the strategy a bit odd in the sense that some of the, at the later stage, the farmers, successful farmers, only had cash crops and also started doing only one of them. So, you know, how many you choose to engage in is a key element because you differently will be able to change this into prices if you have one or more. So he said at first there was a bit of cash crop, then it was just cash crops, and then it was maybe one or two activities around trading and other types of activities. But it is highly risky, and the reason why I took the example was to show why the graduation package will intervene on those specific points where, you know, the one that fell back and, you know, actually they lacked this kind of big push, and this is what the graduation would do. But I'm not advocating for giving up subsistence, although many of them do. Yeah, but you're right. Very good analysis. Indeed. And I didn't answer your question, actually, now that I think about the simulations and the leaf. So I have to say two things. The way the simulations are done is by using Cambodian data exclusively or Vietnam data exclusively. So I didn't use any parameters or coefficients from other country experiences. I only use data from the household survey. So when I use, for example, the propensity to save, or when I used returns on investment, it was always on the basis of what I calculated using the country data. So yes, there is a theoretical framework, and yes, there are equations, and you know there are hundreds, if not thousands, of them. This is true. But nonetheless, this kind of tool has been very useful for many developing countries too. Like, you know, England has, it's not a computable general equilibrium like I use, requires much more data, but it's still a general equilibrium model, and they do have that. You know, France has one, almost any country in the world has one of these monitoring tools that allows you to predict, you know, the direction that the response that you might get from a policy choice. So they're still quite useful and I think quite accurate, but it depends what you do with them, of course. Mm. I personally only used Cambodian data or Vietnamese data, and I didn't input coefficients that I would have guessed, if you want. So I try to minimize the
What's the if we look at the agricultural growth and diversification of Vietnam, another, you know, really quite successful story, especially since they introduced something, you know, follows China's experience really with a stronger set of use rights on the land, if not, you know, not absolute ownership. I mean, Vietnam, that tenure change was really important, even just with Vietnamese liberation. I mean, they had so they never had collectivized to the extent of China. But so they have market reforms. They don't have outright private ownership of land, but they have secure use rights over time. Yeah. How does this story figure in the story of tenure security figure in your approach?
For the ethnic minorities, the land ownership is an important one, but I think it hasn't been reported as a major binding constraint for investment, at least from what I understand. You mean the fact that they do not own the land will refrain them from investing further and engaging in those activities?
Well, the point was in Vietnam, more. I don't know about the situation in the uplands among the minorities, but one of the bases for progress and agricultural growth was a fairly secure use right on the land. But they don't, you know, it's not a land market.
It's not a... No, it's not a land market.
But this clearly must figure, that security of land tenure and behavior of farmers. Maybe something to ask and think about.
Yeah, think
in
about,
your model.
Think about it. No, not in the model, but in the analysis, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a good point. Thank you. I look at that. Yes. Thank you for this.
Okay, we have another couple of questions here.
thank you for your presentation. And I have a question is that you have mentioned the graduation packages include the productive assets and the professional training. I'm just wondering, how do you identify the household's needs for those kind of training and assets? Because just compared to a simple cash transfer, we can let the households to choose themselves. But this one is a fixed provision of these assets and training. So can you design some mechanisms to improve the efficiency of them? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is a question that relates to the sequencing of the graduation package. So it is such a key one that some programs, especially in Latin America, for example, have decided to start with the identification of the needs before transferring. Well, no, the regular monthly cash transfers happen from the start, but the way the package are distributed is as such. There is a stage, a phase during which the communities, so it's as group, it works in terms of communities, they have to get together to decide what their needs are. And so this is a phase that can be quite time-consuming, but that is really important to keep, because this is how the project got formulated. And actually, the woman who was reporting on that at the graduation conference where I was last week, she is the head of... Capital Foundation in Latin America. She said that when they changed into this approach where they gave sufficient time for the participants to formulate what they need in terms of training, the success was much higher than when everything was done, if you want, at the same time. So the asset, then the regular training. And so she said they do not transfer any funds to the local community until they have done the training and the mentoring and reached this stage where they can actually formulate precisely what it is that they need. So they are written projects, and she says that she uses a lot of modern technologies and apps for them to follow the training needed to formulate, to write the proposal, to say exactly what they need. So I think this is a key element. The sequencing of the different elements is key to the success of this. And it has to come from the communities. They know.
Yes.
They know best.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, does this graduation packages scheme assume the household to be one single unit, or is there any sort of attempt to acknowledge the intra-household dynamics? And I'm basically asking, so if you're transferring productive assets, does that go to the household head, or does everyone within that household have some sort of input?
So I know that the... trials that Oriana Bandera has been involved in specifically had this component of targeting women specifically. So in the case of the trials that they experimented, they had this component which is not usually included in graduation packages. So the issue of, intra-household decision is one that hasn't yet been investigated sufficiently for me to provide you with an answer that, you know,
could be applied to Cambodia or to Vietnam. I don't know. I don't know, but I can see why it's an important thing to look at. Again, at this conference last week on graduation, the question was asked specifically, but no one really had an answer to whether it should be included in the condition, in the package or not. In Cambodia, though, the discussion I had with a prime minister economic advisor did imply that they will be more receptive to one where the woman will be involved. So they can see this as one way of improving their, if you want, it's part of what can be done. They see this as something that can be done to empower women. Right? So the link for them is quite clear. I don't know, to be honest. And if it can allow them to consider this as an option, I think I'd be happy to investigate this further, but I don't have a clear answer. Yes.
Harley. Any more questions? Yes.
Hi, thank you. Just, do you have any more examples of where any CGE models have been used in international development?
In international development specifically? Or
yeah.
In social protection? Or
Anything similar to this kind of?
Similar? No. not really. There is a tradition of using studies to answer questions that have to do with either industrial policies, trades, for example, so even rural development at IFPRI. So if you look at the IFPRI website, you will see that they are team, actually I'm using the IFPRI model myself. So you will see examples of how they use for social protection precisely. I know of one series of studies done by Ed Taylor at University of California, University Davis in California, that developed a village economy model. So it's more or less the same, but at the village level. And he looked at the impact of cash transfers. But the problem with a village economy model is that you assume that everything around the village is exogenous. So prices are fixed. So if you do want to sell your goods on local, you know, outside of your village, you will assume that everything else is fixed. So there are advantages because he probably does everything at the household level better than I do. But on the other hand, he can't look at anything like he can't answer questions around scaling up, right? So it's just a different lens that is used to answer the questions. There is a paper that looked at the issue of graduation specifically, but not using a computable general equilibrium model, by Kavoski. It's been published in probably the American Economic Journal. It's a recent publication, really interesting, that also identified the same type of effect that you saw today. If you send me an email, I'll send you the reference. I can send you the links for all those publications if you want, if you're interested.
Okay, we're just about at the end of our time. I think that this is really a good example of putting research money to good use, yeah? And I hope if you were interested in this that you'll also come to the Southeast Asia Forum on May 21st. And without further ado, we want to thank Stephanie Levy for an interesting